How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hi, you're listening to DNA Today, a multi-award-winning podcast and radio show where we discover new advances in the world of genetics. From genetic technology like CRISPR to rare diseases to new research, for over a decade, DNA Today has brought you the voices of leaders in genetics in over 200 episodes. For the past 3 years, DNA Today has won the People's Choice Best Science and Medicine Podcast Award. I'm Kira Dineen. I'm a certified genetic counselor and your host. If you've been listening to DNA Today for a while, you probably know I'm also a full-time prenatal genetic counselor. Between that job, this podcast, and being a producer host of other podcasts, I'm pretty busy. So to keep up my energy and stay productive, I drink a decent amount of coffee. Think like Lorelai Gilmore, but maybe not quite that much. The new coffee I'm drinking is from Four Sigmatic, and I'm really picky about my coffee. It's got to be bold, not watery. That is the worst. I still drink it if I have to, but it's not my favorite. And I have to say, I've been really happy with Four Sigmatic. Here's the difference from other coffees. It includes mushrooms, which I know sounds bizarre. I will admit I was hesitant, but you don't taste the mushroom at all, and you get the health benefits from it. I like the immune system boost as I often get sick in the winter months, so this is really important, and I wanted to team up with Four Sigmatic to get you 30% off using promo code DNA Today, and you can redeem it at foursigmatic.com. Again, that's four, spell it out, F-O-U-R, Sigmatic, S-I-G-M-A-T-I-C.com. Use code DNA Today for 30% off, and let me know if you like it too. In this episode, we're exploring the utilization of rapid whole genome sequencing in the NICU setting. And this is a topic that I just keep referring to in episodes. And I'm like, we have to just do a whole episode dedicated to this because I keep mentioning it. And then I'm like, oh, we run out of time. Joining us for this episode are two experts. Our first expert is Dr. Hong Li, who is a clinical geneticist at Emory University. Our other expert is a recurring guest, world-renowned geneticist Dr. Madhuri Hegde. She serves as the Senior Vice President and Chief Scientific Officer of Global Lab Services at PerkinElmer. If you want to hear Madhuri on other episodes of DNA Today, you can turn into episode 177. We nerded out about the power of whole genome sequencing, which I think is a really good episode to listen to right before this, as it gives a nice overview there. And she was also on episode 202 about Duchenne muscular dystrophy. So thank you both so much for coming on the show here.
Thank you, Kira, for having us.
Thank you, Carrie, and for inviting me to join you to discuss this hot topic in the modern clinical practice. Thank you.
Yeah, it is definitely a hot topic. I swear, it's like every time I go on LinkedIn, I see some kind of article, some kind of comment about it. I'm definitely on LinkedIn too much. But Hong, I would love to have you start just kind of framing our conversations of sharing what symptoms a baby after birth could have that would warrant immediate genetic testing, where we say, all right, we're not going to hold on and just look at symptoms and surveil. We want genetic testing immediately. When you hear that, what's kind of a textbook example, which, I mean, there's probably not even textbooks about this yet, but what would be an example of symptoms that you would see where you really think that immediate genetic testing is warranted?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, there are many symptoms that could indicate the need for immediate genetic evaluation and genetic testing in a baby just born. These symptoms could include abnormal facial features, such as the patient has an abnormal shape or position of the eyes, ears, nose, a cleft palate, a cleft lip, small chin, small or big head size. Another situation could be baby has multiple congenital anomalies or birth defect, such as the complex and the heart defect, kidney abnormality and skeletal anomaly, or even skin abnormalities. And especially when all this in the combination and a multiple combination, that's certainly indicated. Neonatal seizure or a significant abnormal muscle tone, either hypotonia or hypertonia. Both could have a genetic component, especially without any known participating factors such as birth trauma or HIE. So those situations we need to consider genetic evaluation. Another thing, feeding difficulty and failure to thrive without explanation, right? And so there are multiple reasons can cause that. But if you don't have a good explanation, that's warranted a genetic evaluation. I have to say, in general, I always, even teaching other specialties, and when patients' symptoms do not improve with your standard care, when they don't have an explainable cause, you need to think about genetics. And so I think in that situation, genetic evaluation is needed. After the evaluation, we could offer the genetic test. That's what we usually do.
And that's potentially a lot of babies, because you list a lot of different indications, and there's even more than that, I would imagine, too. You're kind of mentioning more of the common ones. And it used to be in genetic testing that panels were kind of the go-to. Like, let's order this group of genes. Maduri, why should we sometimes just start with whole genome sequencing, not even exome, but whole genome, instead of doing, all right, let's look at a panel of genes and then look at whole genome?
Yeah, I think that's a very important question, right? I think we have, in the last 10 years or so, we have come such a long way in technology. And one of the, I would say there are really three reasons. The first one being that the whole genome sequencing is truly unbiased sequencing. And what I mean by that is you're not doing target selection. When you're doing gene panel, you're doing an exome, you're doing target selection. You're only selecting the exons and the flanking intron exon boundaries. Versus with the genome, we're sequencing the entire genome. Now, with that said, we have to remember the caveat that we are doing short read sequencing. And 8% of the human genome was not sequenced at the time when the human genome sequencing was completed. It's only now with the telomere to telomere consortium that gap has been filled. But with the current methods, you're still about 92% sequencing. But you're still significantly more than what you would do with exome or a gene panel. The second reason is really the unbiased nature, because of the target, you're not doing target selection. So you get that uniformity in the sequence across exons, introns, and also the intergenic sequence. And I mentioned that here because it's really important that if you look at any database today and many publications which are coming out, they are talking about deep intronic changes or intergenic changes, which could be important. And genome gives us access to those changes. And third, and probably the most well-known aspect of genome sequencing, is a significant drop in cost, which makes genome sequencing accessible now, especially in the NICU setting.
And that's why at this point in time, it's really starting to happen, as you said, because the cost is dropping. Those reasons have always been there. And the telomere to telomere consortium that you mentioned, I can't remember off the top of my head what episode it is, but we had Dr. Philippi and Dr. Megga on the show and talked about that. And Dr. Eric Green also came on the episode after to chat about it. So it's huge. I mean, we finally actually finished the genome, even though we kind of said we did, like, what was that, 2003? We actually finished it. And that was about a year ago, because I want to say that was like April 2022. I'm intrigued to see how that's going to change. As you said, right now, when you order a whole genome sequencing, it's the short read. But in the future, I imagine that is going to shift to long read. But, you know, maybe we'll have to have you back on for a fourth time to explain that in an episode. But it's interesting, because as you said, a lot of studies are showing that there are a decent amount of changes that are not in the exons, where you'd pick it up with an exome, but it's in these deep intronic regions, like the part that we used to call the junk DNA. And, you know, there's a study I was looking at that suggests up to 15% of disease-causing variants are actually in there, which that seems a little high to me, but I don't know. What do I know? So Hong, I would love to hear a little bit more about, you know, what other tests could be useful for babies in the NICU beyond the genome. I mean, obviously the genome is very comprehensive, but it's one tool. Are there other ones that people should be aware of in terms of, especially for these critically ill babies that are in the NICU?
Yeah, so there currently there are many types and the genetic testing is available. For example, if we have a baby born with typical facial features that suggest a certain condition, common scenario and Down syndrome, we all know, I don't need a genome sequencing. I can just order simple karyotype and confirm the diagnosis. And the cornea delonged syndrome. And so they do have a multiple congenital anomaly and distinguish the facial features. And most geneticists, they recognize that face very well. And so you don't necessarily order like a whole genome sequencing. And also a lot of times and the people know to order chromosomal microarray in a setting with multiple congenital anomaly. But if the geneticist help and recognize the syndrome, we could and go to a small gene panel. The benefit for that is we limited the variance of unknown significance. So it's much targeted testing. The other scenario, I'm the metabolic doctor, and so I have a metabolic lab can guide me what the disease this could be. If the biochemical genetic testing profile showed a specific type of disease, I can just order single gene testing. And yeah, so it's not necessary every baby and the sick baby need whole genome sequencing. Another scenario, which is the limitation of current whole genome sequencing for diagnosing imprinting disease, like Beckwith Wiedemann syndrome, Prader-Willi syndrome. Even you order a whole genome sequencing, there's no some subset cases, there's no sequencing abnormality. It's not appropriate. So I think bottom line is we still need to know the phenotype and still need to integrate all the clinical information together and decide what is the best test option.
Which is why we all still have jobs, because it's important to have a healthcare provider, you know, that can kind of sort it, right? Yeah. And as you were alluding to, the amount of data we get from a whole genome sequence is just tremendous. It's a lot to sort through. And so it's often helpful to say, well, these are some of the symptoms we're looking at, because then we can look at those areas in the genome that we know could be associated. It's kind of like, well, where are we looking first? Maduri, how are labs maximizing the data that they get from the lab from a genome to make sure that they are doing that, that they are finding the relevant information when time is really of the essence for these babies that are really medically ill?
And I think I'm just going to answer that question on the back of what Hong just said, right? And you also mentioned that the data analysis cannot be done in isolation. The clinical information is of utmost importance when analyzing this data. And little and subtle things which may not sound important can become very important when doing data analysis. With regards to the genome, you know, you're getting so much data. So the first thing usually labs do is triage the data with the clinical information. And we call that process gene prioritization with the clinical information. So, you know, as we all know, there are 22,000 genes in the genome. About 7,000 today are known to be causative of some disease. And the idea really is to marry that clinical information with the gene information and see if you can prioritize that information. We can look at the mitochondrial genome from the same genome data. Today, we can also start looking at repeat disorders. In our lab, we are looking at about 40 repeat disorders. We can also look at some genes with some pseudogene sequence. As we all know, it's a little tricky to do that, but we can look at SMA now from the whole genome data. You know, and more recently, which is getting a little bit more exciting for me also personally, and we have started doing this on a clinical research basis, is remember when we are doing genome sequencing, we are actually sequencing everything that is DNA there. So that means that you're sequencing the viral genome or bacterial genome or anything. So we call that metagenomics. And we have just started doing that on a clinical research basis. In fact, we just had a first case in our lab where we could have had a metagenomic finding. But again, the important thing to do and instantaneously to do is what is the clinical information? Is it indicative of an infection? So you can't just go off the ledge and say, oh, there is an infection. You have to marry that with the clinical data. And again, you know, genome data is a piece of the puzzle. It is not a standalone test. It should always be used in conjunction with everything else a physician is doing.
Yeah, I think that's very well said, that we're it's a tool in the toolbox, that we're not just, oh, we can just use this and then we're good. Yeah, I think you guys have really spotlighted that really well. And do you remember the DNA Today episode about epigenetic tests? It was with Greenwood Genetic Center's Dr. Ray Louie and genetic counselor Kelly Walden. We chatted about testing for epigenetic conditions and specifically their diagnostic lab's test, EpiSign. EpiSign included 40 conditions during this initial interview in 2021. So I'm so excited to share with you that version 4 is now available and includes over 70 conditions. They sure have made a lot of great strides in that time. For those that haven't listened to this episode yet, the diagnostic lab at the Greenwood Genetic Center is the only lab in the country to offer this epigenetic test called EpiSign. It's a novel, clinically validated test that analyzes methylation. If you're attending ACMG later this month in Salt Lake City, I recommend stopping by booth 607 to chat with Greenwood to learn more. Brush up on your epigenetics before that by listening to episode 145 of DNA Today and visit ggc.org. Links in the show notes. Which muscular dystrophy causes weakness of the muscles, typically starting around the hips and shoulders? That would be limb-girdle muscular dystrophy, or LGMD. LGMD is a group of neuromuscular diseases caused by mutations in genes responsible for proteins critical for muscle function, regulation, and repair. Sarepta is a global biotechnology company working on engineering precision genetic medicine with the goal of changing the lives of people living with rare muscular dystrophies. Their multi-platform precision genetic medicine engine includes gene therapy, RNA, and gene editing approaches. And that reminds me, ACMG is in March and Sarepta will be at booth 504. You can also head over to limbgirdle.com to learn more. Again, that's limbgirdle.com. For the ultra rapid whole genome sequencing, you guys can use a dried blood spot sample. So I know virtually every baby has that done with the newborn screening, talking about in America, at least. I should preface that by saying in the United States. So can you use that same one or do you need a second one? Like, let's say, you know, with that, can they just do two cards at the same time? Because the dry blood spot is put on a Guthrie card. It's a certain type of paper. So is it as easy as that?
Literally as easy as that. We are routinely getting samples now on DBS cards. And I find it a very important aspect, overall aspect of doing this, right? Because you have parents there. At times, best thing to do is trios, as we know, and parental samples can be collected. You know, it is a time also very difficult for the family. And if you can make that collection easy and transportation of the sample easy, it's very important. It's very easy doing international samples, right? International samples can come just so easily when you are doing a dried blood spot card collection. So the other aspect I should mention is that, remember, every state is doing a different number of newborn screening disorders. So how much the card gets used is also important. So what we have done essentially is we have created a DBS card kit, if we can call it that way, so that it is easy to collect it in the NICU, but the same card, it is exactly the same card used for newborn screening.
I see. Okay. And you mentioned parents with that. So Is trio testing helpful too, as you're kind of sifting through all this data to be like, oh, this is an important variant because we don't see it in either parent, so it's de novo, like that could be a change? Are you able to use parents to quickly rule out variants? Because as we're talking ultra rapid. We're not talking about in a few months getting these results. It's faster than that.
So I can speak about it from the lab perspective, and Hong, you can sort of hopefully add more to that. You know, I mean, from the lab perspective, it is absolutely critical that if we get trios, analysis becomes significantly easier, if not fully definitive. We see the segregation of alleles. We can tell if a variant is de novo. There's a lot you can do if you're doing a trio. One of the things also is that at times, parents do ask for more information on their own genomes. And what we have typically done is that we can issue the ultra rapid report on the baby, and then later on go and do more extensive analysis on the parents and give them their reports as well. But I think as we all know, the primary reason is to avoid that number of variants of unknown significance, especially if clinically relevant and it's matching the clinical phenotype. You know, we always talk to the physicians. It's a very much an interactive process, right, Hong?
Yeah. So trio, I certainly prefer and a trio if possible, because a lot of recessive condition, you could identify two variants. If it is a known pathogenic variant, that's easy. But if it is novel variants and you don't know they are in trans or in cis, so that's not helpful. Sometimes finding two variants doesn't mean this is cause the disease if they're in cis, right? So I think a trio is preferred in that setting, and it's very helpful. I want to add from clinical point. So we know every disease and has some variability, and we actually don't know much about the natural history of all the rare diseases, especially the new identified ones. So intrafamilial variation exists. And so sometimes even though most of the variants in that condition is de novo, we do see inherited, right? That's sometimes very difficult for lab to decide if it is inherited from mom, dad, but they don't have the information of the parent's phenotype. And so it's easy to classify as likely benign because it's inherited. So this is emphasize the communication between the clinician and the lab people. And so I think this is a teamwork, definitely, to find the right diagnosis.
Yeah, I think that's well said in spotlight of how important it is to have a healthcare team all involved with this, that you've got to have multiple experts with this. And, you know, speaking from kind of a multiple perspective, I'm thinking ultra rapid whole genome sequencing really ends up reducing costs at the end of the day when you're looking at, you know, all the other different costs that can be associated when a baby is critically ill. What are we looking at in terms of, you know, numbers or just getting a sense of things? Aduri, we could start with you of looking at, you know, are there tremendous savings? Like, is this preventing other testing from possibly being ordered?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think we have to look at it in two perspectives, right? One is the time to diagnosis. If you're doing a whole genome, and if it is warranted, as Hong already mentioned at the start of the podcast, that if clinically warranted, whole genome sequencing can save a significant amount of time to diagnosis. And that naturally translates into all the in-between different tests, investigative tests that are going to be done. That directly translates into the cost, overall cost of having the baby in the NICU and the stay in the NICU. I think there are plenty of studies that have been published which have talked about the cost of a stay in the NICU for the baby, and the overall cost that is associated with the hospital having to give those services. From the lab perspective, it definitely makes a big difference. Cascade testing, if you're going from panel to exome to a genome, aside from the lost time, also is increasing the cost of testing itself. So overall, I think definitely a reduction in healthcare cost. And, you know, Hong can talk a lot about, you know, the sort of the follow-up and where those cost savings come about.
Yeah, the other situation right now, let's say we have a patient who has a multiple congenital anomaly. We start with the first tier testing, chromosomal microarray, and then if we go to exome sequencing, and the combination of the test is probably and higher than you just directly order rapid rapid whole genome sequencing, and the time was significantly decreased, right? And when you wait a microarray, it takes probably 5, 7, 10 days, another exome, and it takes another several weeks, and so it's not helpful in critically ill patients who require immediate diagnosis.
And how long is an average turnaround time? I think it'd be great to hear how long it is just for a normal whole genome sequence, and then for an ultra rapid whole genome sequence, like in this NICU setting, because I've heard a lot of different timelines.
So essentially, we can return the results of an ultra rapid whole genome in about 24 to 48 hours. And that's very
fast.
That is very fast, right? The thing to remember is you have to count in for the transportation of the sample to the lab, and actual loading on the sequencer. What we have, most labs today are publishing a turnaround time of about 5 days. And we ourselves have ended up somewhere between about 24 to 56 hours. You know, one of the important things is the communication before you actually even issue the report. Once we have the result, we immediately call it out because, you know, the physician, like Hong, is waiting at the other end wanting to know, and they can start, you know, taking some actions as we are preparing to send the report. Going fast also means you're increasing cost. Remember, the sequencers are, you know, we can call them beasts because they eat a lot, meaning you need to feed them a lot. And if you're not loading the sequencers fully and to their capacity, that means you're increasing the cost of sequencing itself. So there are different ways of looking at it, but typically it is anywhere between 24 hours to 5 days. And it depends on how the sample arrives, when the sample arrives. But I think the labs are doing a phenomenal job with that. The cost is a separate aspect of all of this. And we have tried in every way to minimize the cost and still returning all the data we just talked about in terms of maximizing the output from a genome.
Yeah, it's important to be able to balance the two, but I think turnaround time is more important in these cases than cost, which, you know, maybe some people would disagree. But, you know, talking about getting these results, Hong, I'd love to hear more from you in terms of how these results can actually influence treatment plans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so definitely. And if we find the answer, and that's first, then you make a clear diagnosis, right? So it's easy and for the families and for the providers, and what's the next step we can offer to the patients. And also in some cases, and the early diagnosis and the treatment can be life-saving. For example, rapid whole genome sequencing can help us and identify those genetic variants and increase the risk of certain metabolic conditions, which allow us to provide appropriate and dietary management and early intervention. I give you an example I encountered in practice. So a couple years ago, we published a paper of a case of hereditary fructose intolerance. So usually those cases presented after the winning breast milk, like a breast milk feeding, and then they introduce the fruit and then they present symptoms. But what happened is the formula company added the fructose and sucrose into the formula to increase the sweetness, and so has a better tolerability. And so these patients with hereditary fructose intolerance cannot metabolize the fructose. And so when they give the formula feeding, you're basically feeding the baby the toxin. So that's in the can leading to the liver dysfunction. And we presented four cases with liver failure because they just give the formula. And so nobody knows, and a newborn came in with liver failure. Of course, there are tons of and workup being placed. And so if we have a rapid genome sequencing, identify the case, the only treatment is change the formula. And so it's a significant changing the patient's outcome. So some patients end up put on transplant. So it was a stunting data, and you can you see. So the other case, I would say, very commonly, and a neonatal seizure caused by pyridoxine-dependent seizure, vitamin B treatment is very effective. However, in subset patients, the regular dose of B6, 100 milligram, may not work well. So you give patients a trial, it didn't work well, you thought this is not the case. And so you change other anti-epilepsy medication, maybe require multiple medication. But if we have a results, confirm the diagnosis, you may need to increase a dose of B6. That's in that can take other medication away. And also in long-term, there is a triple therapy, including dietary management, arginine supplementation to treat this disease very specifically. So I think the diagnosis, definitive diagnosis, definitely can change patient's management. Another example I want to add here is, I mentioned some cases, and based on the biochemical profile, I can narrow down to certain metabolic condition, but not in a differentiate them one type to another type. One example is urea cycle disorder. Unfortunately, proximal urea cycle defect, there are three enzymes defect and was not included in newborn screening. And so however, those patients, classic patients or severe patients, does present in neonatal period, even like in day two or day three, has a hyperammonemia. And so we know, and the timing is very important. And if patients has a hyperammonemia, and we give a medication, we give a dialysis. And so the dialysis can also change your biochem profile. And so it's very difficult to differentiate three proximal urea cycle disorder. But one of them is called NAX deficiency and has a specific oral medication. And so if you know that, and it will be significantly helpful in the patient's management. Some patients don't even require dietary management. They just take a couple pills and then it's manageable. So I think early diagnosis is really important. And if we can get the answer, that's wonderful. Of course, and we probably will talk about some limitation as well. I think timing is critical for baby, and it can be life-saving.
Yeah, it definitely can. I mean, you just highlighted some really interesting cases, like even, you know, with the hereditary fructose intolerance that you mentioned, it's like, yeah, treatment is like, just don't give baby fruit. Like, you're just extremely allergic to fruit is kind of one way of thinking about it. And your body just can't break it down. It builds up to toxic levels. And it's like, for that baby to possibly having a liver transplant when the solution is so simple, it's like, you know, that is just so important. I'm so glad you were able to share so many cases with us. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that there's some major projects happening right now that are using rapid whole genome sequencing in the NICU setting. I know about Project Baby Bear. There's also Project Baby Deer over in Michigan. How do you see these projects paving the way for this to maybe have it be feasible to have this be standard of care in NICUs? And then maybe eventually, which I keep alluding to on episodes, of having this replace newborn screening. Obviously, we need kind of different steps in there. But how do you see these projects helping to pave the way? Are we going to see more projects? What do we need to get there?
Maybe I can give my take first. So yes, obviously these projects are very important. I think we need data, and data gives us evidence, which helps us sort of talk to the insurance providers and the physicians and convince obviously the hospital administrators that this is very important to do. But with that said, I think we have to be very careful when we talk something as big as newborn screening. Newborn screening has been around for about 60, 70 years now. And, you know, newborn screening is a system. It's an ecosystem of several things. It is not just, you know, doing early screening for 50 disorders, right? There is so much that happens in that entire ecosystem of newborn screening. You have, you know, the counseling piece of it, the follow-up piece of it. There are just a tremendous amount of activity around the actual screening activity. Having said that, there is a lot of activity now happening in that area too, where there are considerations and there is thought process going on around replacing newborn screening the way we do today with genome sequencing. And we actually, from our own lab, we have just submitted a manuscript of probably the first manuscript for 600 babies, healthy genome sequencing. And one thing I think is very clear to us, right, that it's not something which is can be easily put into a system and just taken as a uniform format across, let's just say, US. There is going to be a lot of work that has to be done before that happens. But let's not forget one very important thing. The newborn screening is, most of it is today biochemical screening. Those are functional assays. And we are talking a lot about omics now. We simply cannot step away from those. Knowing the phenylalanine level, knowing the metabolite level is absolutely critical. And so in my opinion, I don't think we are in the sort of getting closer to replacing newborn screening. I think the format of newborn screening could change in the next decade or so, but it's not a replacement. I think
it's kind of like doing it extra.
Yeah, or a combinatorial approach is how I look at it. Hong, what do you think?
Yes, I completely agree. So newborn screening is targeted with you have a significant clinical impact and also you have a treatment available. So we are not screening the disease without effective treatment. And also we have a biochem, like for metabolic, just for metabolic disease, we have a biochemical profile we can recognize. And so if we offer genome sequencing, we find a variance on those genes, how should we change the management? Are we sure that's the disease cause variance if it is a novel? Are we sure it's trends and for the recessive condition? Are we sure it's gonna delay the diagnosis because we didn't have a bowel cam available by 7 days. Usually this baby present very early on, and some of them, despite we have a newborn screening, some baby presented before the results available. So I think it's if we implement the whole genome sequencing in the clinical practice or population screening, we have to have some functional study available to help interpret the variants identified. I think that's very important because otherwise it's going to delay the already screened metabolic conditions. Yeah,
you have to have that information behind it before you start, you know, enacting it. Well, thank you so much. I mean, Maduri Hong, thank you so much, because you guys just have so much information. You're so well spoken on these topics, and you're just, I could talk to you guys all day on this. You bring so much energy and everything. So thank you so much. This is a topic that's, you know, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we've kind of mentioned this in many episodes, and I'm like, we got to do a whole episode just focused on rapid whole genome sequencing, you know, in the NICU and beyond, really, is what we're kind of getting at with that last question. So thank you both so much. Really appreciate it. Hong, go ahead.
Yeah, I have one comment. And if you plan for future topic, and one of the ethical and the legal aspect of the whole genome sequencing, it's a good topic to discuss, and nobody have a clear answer. I think generate the productive discussion will raise the awareness, especially for new NICU baby, and in that extremely stressful situation, how we do inform consent, and how that gonna affect parents and experience. I think that's also very important, because the data utilization, how to store privacy, confidentiality, and all those are very important. But it's very difficult to educate or consent the family in that extremely stressful setting. I feel I don't want the parents and just to focus, I want to get the answer, but forget the other side of whole genome sequencing. That's very important. I think in the future, significant guideline and need to be set up if we want to move forward faster. And yeah, it definitely team work, include multiple stakeholder and join the discussion, come up with some guideline and to help the process.
Yeah, thank you so much, Hong, for saying that, because I think that that's kind of almost like a part two of this conversation, because we didn't have time to dive into, you know, the logistics and the informed consent, and like, you know, you're not just getting information that's relevant to baby at that point. You're getting information that may be relevant when they're 90 years old or 50 years old. So, yeah, it's kind of like, well, what are we doing with this? How are we doing follow-up, or are we doing follow-up? Yeah, yeah. All right. Stay tuned, listeners. Part two at some point in the future. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've enjoyed recording a few episodes about epigenetics. One of the interviews where I learned the most was with the diagnostic labs at the Greenwood Genetic Center. They taught me about EpiSign, which is a novel clinically validated test that analyzes methylation. I just learned that since this episode aired in 2021, version 4 of EpiSign has been released, which has expanded to include over 70 conditions. If you're attending ACMG this month, stop by booth 607 to chat with Greenwood Genetics. In the meantime, brush up on your epigenetics by listening to episode 145 of DNA Today, and visit ggc.org, link in the show notes. Which muscular dystrophy causes weakness of the muscles, typically starting around the hips and shoulders? That would be limb girdle muscular dystrophy, or LGMD. LGMD is a group of neuromuscular diseases caused by mutations in genes responsible for proteins critical for muscle function, regulation, and repair. Sarepta is a global biotechnology company working on engineering precision genetic medicine with the goal of changing the lives of people living with rare muscular dystrophies. Their multi-platform precision genetic medicine engine includes gene therapy, RNA, and gene editing approaches.
And that reminds me, ACMG is in March and Sarepta will be at booth 504. You can also head over to limbgirdle.com to learn more. Again, that's limbgirdle.com. For more information about today's episode, visit dnatoday.com, where you can also stream all 200 plus episodes of the show, including video versions of interviews recorded in 2021 or later. Any questions, episode ideas, guest pitches, or sponsor inquiries can be sent into info@dnatoday.com. Be sure to follow us on social media, especially so you don't miss a giveaway. We are at DNA Today Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and more. Please rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. This truly helps us climb the charts and allow more genetic nerds like yourself to find the show. Here's a bonus. If you do and send us a screenshot, I'll give you a shout out on the show. DNA Today is created, hosted, and produced by myself, Kira Dineen. Our team includes communications lead, Corinne Merlino, video lead, Amanda Andrioli, outreach intern, Sonia Tanaker, social media intern, Kajal Patel, and graphic designer, Ashlyn Anokian. Thanks for listening, and join us next time to discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, are all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.